Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Frontside Podcast, episode 28. My name is Charles Lowell. I'm a developer and founder here at the Frontside. I'm also here with Brandon and Stanley. Hey, guys.
Hello.
Hey.
And we have a special guest.
Yep. We are here with Trek Glowacki, who is not only on the Ember core team, but also maintainer of Pretender.js and overall JavaScript Raconteur. Is it? Do you think that's a fair title?
I do sing in JavaScript. Yes, that's what I. What I do. Yep. You can if you hear.
That's what he's known for.
You can hear the semicolons as pauses at the end of every line.
Awesome. So welcome, Trek.
Thank you.
So yes, we're super glad to have you on. There's a million things that we would like to talk to you about. Do lots of open sourcey stuff. You've done some really cool talks in the past. But before we really dive into any of that stuff, truly your life is that of legend. But for those few who do not know, I'd love to know more about like how you got into programming, kind of what your background is and how you and what you're basically what you're up to today.
For sure. I think my programming history is pretty typical of someone my age. I'm 34, so I started programming late 90s, early 2000s, pretty typical. I do not come from a software or engineering background. I have a degree in English literature. But as many people of that period did, I was the person good with computers and so started doing computer stuff. And that very quickly evolved into programming. After that, I ended up getting a more computer-related master's degree. I have a master's degree in human-computer interaction, which is pretty programming-focused. And so I just started coding as many people do, just picking it up on my own, and have been doing it for 15 years now, which makes me feel very old.
I'm not going to tell you it doesn't make you old. Like, I don't know what you're waiting for me.
No. I'm responsible for my feelings. I'm just saying it makes me feel old. So other than the open source things I've done, you may have heard of, I worked at a company called Groupon. They sell, I believe, hot yoga coupons at half off, and also LASIK eye surgery. And I was there for like 3 years, pretty good gig, and it was time to move on. And now I'm doing a startup thing with a couple friends of mine, a bunch of ex-Groupon people and a bunch of non-ex-Groupon people. The company's called Popular Pays, and we are, I don't really have an elevator pitch because I don't have to do business, but we're like Pinterest for cats. No, we're like Uber. we're like Tinder for brands that want to find social media influencers to help them do better advertising. That's actually a legitimate description now that I think about it.
And the advertisers are like, new phone, who dis?
Yes, exactly.
Clorox, swipe
yeah,
right.
Yeah, exactly. Clorox, swipe right. That's a great one. I'm going to take note of that. Right, swipe. Right, okay, excellent. It's fun. Back to doing startups, it's kind of a change. I mean, Groupon is a multi-hundred person engineering team, maybe in the thousands at this point. Engineering team here is six people, so quite a change.
And you were working across a lot of teams, if I remember correctly, at Groupon, and you had a lot of influence over a lot of people at more of an architectural level. And now I'm assuming are you more hands-on than you were before, or were you pretty much hands-on before?
Yeah. So, I mean, at Groupon, I think the goal was to have influence of a lot of people. I think part of leaving Groupon was it's too big for any one person to have a ton of influence. And so, like, my area of expertise right now is client-side JavaScript. My team and I, a bunch of us sort of banded together and formed a team, which is, props to Groupon that three people can just be like, we know stuff about a thing and we're going to form a team to do that. And being allowed to do that is really awesome. But just like convincing people that the way we were doing client-side JavaScript was like not going to support our engineering efforts into the future was just a major uphill battle. And so we did a lot of training and we convinced a lot of people to like separate client and server. I don't think we had the impact that I would have liked, but I went in with pretty lofty goals. So, now I'm much more hands-on. I'm in the code base of the main products, every day, all day long. So
So you have you had said you were doing like human computer interaction stuff. Mm-hmm. You have a different background than a lot of developers do, and you bring a different perspective. And a couple of years ago, you gave a talk at EmberCamp that I think to me was the most memorable about a different way of approaching these problems from a human computer interaction standpoint. And I thought it was interesting, first and foremost, that you were speaking at this thing at a technology that I almost basically just barely heard of. Mm-hmm. And I want to dive in a moment into like some of the ideas that you have there. But also, I'm curious as to how you got involved with Ember. You were pretty darn early. So I wanted to find out how that all happened.
Yeah, I have a good track record of picking kind of next wave technologies. I started doing... I started programming like late 90s, early 2000s, mostly Java PHP stuff, which isn't quite true. I actually first tried to teach myself to program on a school computer, the first computer I ever had access to at 15 in C++. And C++ is not, I would not recommend anyone approach that as their first programming language, especially going at it on your own. It is not a language that engenders a love of software engineering into anyone. So I left that feeling like, well, I'm just too stupid to do programming.
That's how I feel every time I work on the Ruby Racer with Charles. I think he feels that way too, because we're working with C++.
Yeah,
it's terrible.
C++ is rough.
It's a mountain of just like dying and being like, well, what went wrong? And it's like, I don't know.
Yeah. It's tough too. Cause we're on such a tangent. I've started to play around with, game development, which is very, depending on which game engine you're using, and obviously I'm going to use a game engine because I'm not going to write that stuff from scratch, very C++ heavy. Unless you're using Unity, which is, I think, becoming my preference because you can use C#, a language which I actually quite like. In my mind, it feels like a better Java. I don't know that I'd be super happy using it day in and day out, but I think Microsoft has done a really, really good job. And like the one remaining thing that really bugged me about C# was its proprietary nature. But Microsoft has become the sudden poster child for open source and all these things, which is, I think, phenomenal. So I was doing, long tangent about uninteresting things. I was doing a lot of PHP, a lot of Java, right as Rails came out. And Rails, I think I was like hitting peak dissatisfaction with PHP and Java for different reasons. Java, because I just got tired of writing,
public abstract, static void.
Yeah. Abstract, in front whatever, of everything. Class factory. Yeah, it seemed very heavyweight, and it has an exactness to it that I don't think is necessary. Like other languages have an exactness to them that I think is actually highly communicative. And in Java, I always felt the requirement for exactness was to make the compiler happy as opposed to better communicate to people working on this project. And in PHP, I was getting frustrated because, PHP was nothing. It's a template language where you can execute arbitrary logic. It was at the time. I think it's improved significantly since then. But at the time, it was just a template language with arbitrary logic and very little structure around it. And in the 04, 05 era, I think, was when people started to put a little bit of logic, wanting to separate out, flow control from rendering, from data model access kind of thing. And that was all happening right around the time that Rails came out. So I picked up Rails. I worked on it. It was either Thanksgiving or Christmas break 2004. So this is, 0.4, 0.5 days. And have been doing Rails actively for a decade now. So that bet ended up winning. It really felt like a breath of fresh air compared to what I'd been doing before. And I saw, as many people did, the potential for not just what it was, but what it could turn into.
And it was so controversial too, really, at that time.
Yes, it was so... Well, for really good reasons, like the early Rails days, for people who are not around during those times, it was not great. It was better than going at it alone on PHP. But in terms of like tooling available to you, Java would win hands down, right? Like just the IDEs and just the sheer number of libraries available for Java compared to Ruby at that time, and anything around Rails was just like, why would you ever pick anything but Java at this point? But I think many people picked it not so much for what it was, but for like they could see like this is a good start, and the direction it's going in is going to really be great, and I think that turned out to be true. But it was pretty pretty bad in the early days. Stuff would break all the time. It wasn't terribly performant. The APIs were kind of wonky. DHH was adamant that JavaScript was a horrendous thing no one should ever write. They should write their Ruby that would turn into JavaScript, which is, I think, opinions he still has a decade later. But yeah, it was really, really good. So I started doing Rails very early and have kept with it for quite a long time. And it's I have some early Rails commits, nothing like contributions to other libraries I've done, but some early Rails commits. And watching that evolve as both a project and as a community of practice has been really great. I think Rails right now is in an utterly fantastic place. For me, Rails is the now I treat Node or Express like other people treated Rails when they were Java developers. Like, why would you do anything other than Rails? There are so many libraries and such good tooling. But the one thing that Rails wasn't doing for me in my client work, I kept getting requests from clients like, oh, you know, and can it do something like this? You know, like Facebook has it, or like, you know, like I see in Gmail. And what they were expressing really was a more client application like behavior that you could get with Rails, but it just never felt natural. And so this probably was like 2010, 2011. And that's when I started figuring out like, okay, like my jQuery abilities will not avail me. This will not let me build the quality of interaction that people are starting to expect as that bar goes up. And that bar is being raised by companies with massive budgets. And I'm, you know, basically the only developer in a one-man consultancy doing engineering. Like, how do I, you know, where's Rails for JavaScript was basically what I wanted.
Right. You feel like you're building this like jQuery house of cards.
Yeah. Nested selectors inside selectors inside selectors with events that do more selectors. And it just became like, it's very, to me, it felt like the old joke about Perl, like Perl is write only as a programming language. Cause you come back to it, even as the author, you're like, I don't understand what this is anymore. And so as many people did in those times, I started building my own frameworks to use. I actually ran across one of them. And it is a little weird. All the terminology I used that I must have like borrowed from probably Cocoa and the Apple libraries, but terms like outlets, components, controllers, like those all existed in this very early, really awful framework that, you know, no one should ever use. But
can you name it?
I never gave it a name. It was just something I was using internal. But I'll find it. We'll put it in the show notes. You have show notes, right?
Okay. We got show notes.
We'll put it in the show notes. Yeah. I will post. I think I posted a gist of it like a year or two ago. Finding it was like, whoa, it's so weird to see. And even that, like, that was like my desperate attempt to be even slightly more organized. And even that was insufficient to the task. So I started looking around once I realized like this still wasn't enough. And I didn't have the chops at the time to tackle a problem like this alone, nor does anyone probably. So I started looking around for what was out there. And at the time, the major things, XJS,
Knockout maybe?
I don't think Knockout was even around at the time. Backbone was not.
GWT?
GWT was a thing. Cappuccino was a thing. And then Sprout Core was a thing. This is very early Sprout Core days. So I have some early Sprout Core commits. And so I played around with Cappuccino, and that was a bridge too far. For people that don't know, Cappuccino is probably one of the first examples of a compiled to JavaScript language out there. It was developed by some grad students in what I suspect is like a bid to get acquired by Apple. They wrote a new language called Objective-J, which was like Objective-C, and it would compile to JavaScript, and you would write client-side applications in Objective-J in this framework Cappuccino that they had written, which, I mean, if you can imagine like how commonplace compiling from one language to JavaScript, or even compiling from one version of JavaScript to another version of JavaScript, like how common that is today, they were really out in the front of that whole world. And I cannot even imagine, like, there wasn't, like, projects like Babel really get to float on the fact that there's like a defined AST and known AST tooling. This didn't exist at the time. So I think they like literally even wrote their own JavaScript parser to turn it into an abstract syntax tree. Anyway, that was, that was crazy town. And Sprout Core was a little more reasonable, but also really, they really eschewed that, like, they didn't use the native technology. So I already knew HTML and CSS. And needing to, like, use their Vue programming language felt very clunky to me. And kind of weird. Like, I've done a limited amount of...
This is the cappuccino?
No, this is Sprout Core.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Sprout Core, like, obviously you wrote it in JavaScript, but everything was JavaScript. Like, they didn't have really a template layer. Their Vue layer was just more JavaScript. And that eventually would express itself as HTML and as CSS. And in the limited amount of iOS and mobile development I've done, I actually really prefer HTML and CSS as a language for describing layout. What elements are on a page. Prior to Flexbox, I think layout and CSS was obviously just a nightmare, and stuff like Cocoa did away, or I guess whatever the iOS framework is, AppKit did a way better job of that. But yeah, at the time it was just like, I know HTML and CSS. I don't want to describe my views in JavaScript. That seems like a step back. And so I took a step back from Sprout Core as well. And that's around when Backbone came out. So I did Backbone and was very enthusiastic about Backbone for like 6 months, and then really hit the end of that road as well. Like it definitely cleaned up what was jQuery code. And then the complexity, or like the robustness of applications that people were asking for, there was more, and Backbone didn't offer any tools beyond what it already had to solve those problems. So I was like, okay, well, what goes on top of Backbone, or what replaces Backbone? And this is where Knockout, Angular, Ember were sort of the Batman, I guess, was a big contender at the time. And so I started playing with a lot of them, and ended up picking Ember mostly. It's actually really funny. I was mostly just trolling them for how awful it was, and how it was just missing a ton of things. And Yehuda was like, yes, absolutely, I agree. Like, describe to me all the things you think need to be in a framework for it to be building client-side applications in the browser. And so we like tweeted back and forth. He's like, great, point me to the project you think is further along in that task. And I was like, well, no one is. He's like, exactly, get in and help, let's go. And so that's when I started contributing. And it's funny, people bemoan the lack of learning resources for new frameworks, sort of as a rule. This happened in Rails. I've started to play with game development. Everyone, like, every time a new game engine comes out, the number one complaint is, why do we need another game engine? And why is the documentation so bad? And how come there are no blog posts? Like, so people complain, obviously, about Ember because it's a new thing, and there are not as many learning resources as they might be accustomed to if they've started using Rails 10 years into its history. but like, when I, like, people are like, oh, it's so hard to learn Ember. Like, there's no docs. Like, no, there were no docs when I started. Like, literally, there were no comments. There was nothing written. We didn't even,
it was still mostly just yanked out of Sprout Core, yes, then too, right?
There weren't even require statements. So you literally didn't even have an understanding of like, what's the most user facing dependency and what is the tree of internal dependencies below that? Not like that didn't exist. Like the whole thing was just basically one file, everything attached to globals, and the dependency graph was implicit. So you had no idea, like should I be using the run loop directly? Like what's the thing I should be doing? And there were no sample apps. I mean, there was basically nothing. So one of the first tasks I had was to basically crack open every file, read through it, figure out how it related to the other files, and start writing first sort of large block preamble documentation at the head of every class, and then moved into method by method documentation. So there was a point where, this isn't true anymore because the community has done such a good job of getting in and participating, but there was a point where probably the API docs were 95% content that I had authored in the process of learning Ember.
And I think I can, I didn't realize that this was all you, but it's some of the best documented code you're likely to run across anywhere. And I guess that's due to a really concerted effort.
Yeah, I doubt that's all me anymore. I won't claim credit for that because the community has been phenomenal about continuing that process. Mm-hmm. In fact, one of the things we did right before doing a 1.0 release was a couple weeks of, and I think I remember saying to the rest of Core, like, I will vehemently block a 1.0 release unless we have done this. was a audit of all the API documentation for correctness and for completeness. And so basically I made a list of every class and every method, and people went through and just checked off if they audited it and what they were adding. And so that was a huge effort. That was probably, I think we had like 30 or 40 contributors to that work in the few weeks leading up to 1.0. And that is probably what beefed up our API documentation in the 1x series the most, was that community effort. Robert Jackson actually was his first commit. Was just before 1.0. He was part of the documentation push, and now he basically runs the show.
Yeah, you were at that time sort of the documentation czar. I think anybody that was doing Ember back then knew you for that.
Yeah.
And it seems like that's not necessarily it anymore. You kind of got roped into the feature side and all that stuff.
Yep.
Do you still feel some responsibility over that, or do you feel like other people have taken that over and you don't have to really worry about it anymore?
So two community members have basically taken over the guides. And this is generally, I think, how Ember wants to function as a project and as a community. The core team is responsible for setting direction and sort of picking like large coarse grain parameters of where we would like the project to go. And the project is not just obviously the Ember library, but also Ember data, the inspector, the build tools, the documentation, the guide site, everything around that basically. And so we brainstormed a sort of coarse grain table of contents for content reorganization and additions to the guides for 2.0, but it's mostly been a community effort at this point. I attend the meeting and I comment on pull requests occasionally, but it's mostly an effort just sort of going off on its own. I don't know where that's going to end up. It might be wildly successful. It might be a catastrophic failure, but this is the way we have to operate, right? As a community project, we live and die by contributions. And if the contributions are not up to muster, we need to just keep working at it until they are. And if they're great, that's what drives a project forward. And then the API stuff is in a pretty solid place. I would say API docs are pretty good. I do have a project to get them versioned that I should be working on literally as we speak. But,
we're causing there. Material harm to the Ember project by having this podcast.
Yes, yes,
that's
we are.
That's good to know. Yeah.
It became especially urgent with the move to 2.0, obviously, because now if you look at the API docs, they're about 2.0, which means it was a little confusing before because you'd see a method and you'd have to know to look for like the since parameter to see like, am I using a version of Ember where this is actually present? It became much more urgent in 2.0 with the removal of a lot of things because now you want to find documentation about methods and they're just gone. That is bad. That is bad.
It's certainly how I know that like API doc is so... It's so wonderful for Rails, especially when you're spanning huge versions. Like yes. If you're jumping major versions, being able to look, have maybe 15 versions of a method or a class or something and be able to just pop between them and see kind of how it's evolved and where if it moved, where it went and
it's,
things like that.
My preference in documentation is almost always for API documentation. I find guides rarely to be useful for me, for just my particular learning style, where I have trouble understanding a thing until I've walked around the entire landscape and seen a little bit of everything, which often feels a little bit like a learning disability. Cause like, people will say a couple things, be like, I don't get it. I don't get it. I don't get it. And then I've sort of like touched every little part of it. Like, oh, I get it now and get it at a very complete level. But it just takes me so long. So if you look at like, any output I have, it tends to come in bizarre bursts of like dead silence for weeks and months at a time. And then just like sudden high output that stays pretty steady. I think most frustrating for me, at least, is when I start a new job, my output tends to drop to zero for a couple months. And then, before shooting up. And I'm in that space right now, which is why it is especially salient for me because I've been in a new job for about 6 weeks and I'm still like, wait, what's that class do again? I don't understand. Like its name doesn't make sense to me yet.
Yeah, just from the absence. So I have another question. Kind of taking a different tack, because I think, I mean, you've clearly done a ton with this stuff, but you're kind of wrapped up in all of this code side, and you have I want to talk a little bit about sort of getting pigeonholed. I think people wanted to think of you as an API person when you were the API czar of stuff, and people probably know you from work in a different context where you're, you know, the person that does this, or you're an Ember person, or you're this kind of person, and you seem to have a lot to say and think about in terms of user experience that I don't see you. I don't know if you do this at your day job, but you gave a talk that I thought was sort of like a landmark talk about composition of user experience into components that didn't really come to fruition until much later in Ember. And do you feel like, I don't know, do you feel like you've said what you need to say about that? Or is there more, like more territory to explore with like the confluence of the way that we write our code and the kind of experiences we create for people?
It's that's actually, I mean, thanks for the compliment about the talk. That's actually of all the talks I've given, my favorite to have given, and also I think just came out the best, which is hilarious because I was incredibly ill during that talk.
Really?
Yeah, I had just downed a bunch of cough suppressant because I could not stop coughing all night before.
So you were like tripping on Robo.
I was Robo tripping. Yeah, I was actually Jameson Dance, who is on JavaScript Driver very frequently. You know, America's Jameson Dance.
TV's Jameson Dance
was kind enough to let me squat in his hotel because at the time the place I was working did not pay for my open source efforts, and so I was trying to do it on the cheap. And I just like was I just became suddenly violently ill. It was bad times. And then Tom Dale was like, hey, we're running short on time. Can you give your 30-minute talk in 15 minutes? Wow. And I said, I mean, for Tom Dale, anything, right? So that talk is really good. We'll put it in the show notes, obviously. But the premise of it is the way we reuse code has tended to be in two diametrically opposite worlds about reuse, and the research on it tends to use the term reuse in two ways. Reuse in the large, which is, I guess, what we would consider not really frameworks. Like a WordPress shopping cart plugin would be reuse in the large, where what it does covers many types of functionality, right? It is presentation, it is flow control, it is data persistence, it is probably asynchronous behavior, and talks to other APIs. Reuse in the small, which is its opposite, is what you would consider libraries, right? Like just a function call or an object that has some behavior. And frameworks like Rails or Ember really sit in this weird place of being in between the two of them, and basically providing a language to combine reuse in the small into your own reuse in the large, which tends not to be super reusable. And so, yeah, at the time I was talking about like how would we write user experiences in Ember, I guess views at the time. And we really couldn't do it. No one could, right? This notion of composition was mm-hmm. simply not possible given any of the technologies. And by composition, I mean, some of the examples I gave was like a photo carousel, like you'd see if you go to Facebook and click a photo. You can go left and right to page through people's photos, is not dissimilar in implementation or experience from a date picker, where you're paging left and right through a series of dates, usually grouped by month. And yet the actual code we use to craft those is usually not shared. It is usually, you know, handcrafted for each of those examples, despite how much they share an example or in common. And then the truly sad part of the reuse is if a photo carousel does most of what you need, but you need to swap out, let's say, the pagination behavior you have is slightly different, it usually does not expose to you, like, please insert your pagination behavior here. You have to throw it away and write it wholesale, which is a bummer. And so the talk was about, like, can we do better? And I think Ember components are, especially with the block argument, are finally to the point where we can realize like true composability and proper reuse, where I can take a off-the-shelf component that is composed of other smaller components and use it as is, or I could be like, you know, actually, like, everything about it is good, but I need special behavior around a text input. And here is my text input that I would like you to use. And everything else should behave as is documented by the public API. I think we're finally at that point in Ember, which is fantastic.
So do you think that's something that tools can encourage, or something, a style of work that needs to be taught? Or is, you know, like, how do we get that to a larger number of people to increase shareability and general programmer happiness?
I think it's a style that needs to be taught, and probably that will come from members of the Ember community. Almost certainly we're going to get this wrong, right? Like, people are going to start using, and they already have released things like a date picker. And that date picker is intended to be used as just a black box, right? Like a single unit, and it has particular behavior that you can configure with options. And what I would like to get to is the date picker, like, you could still release that as a library, but the more important part is that the pagination, the date generation, the event handling are all actually separate components that ship on their own, right? Like, I really want to get to a world where everyone paginates in Ember the same way. And that might be pagination server to client. It might be paging through collections already loaded on the client. And I just want one thing that does that to be the standard.
I see you and Charles sitting on like a grassy mountainside sipping bottles of Coca-Cola.
Because it's really good. Like, I'm trying to think of logic I've written again and again. Like, modal.
Certainly pagination falls into that category where you're just like, again and again. To me, yes. It almost feels like there's like, do you ever feel like you want to kind of scratch beneath the surface and even get below the components and have kind of some simple model of objects that represent the pagination that then you can layer your components on top of.
I certainly think
that the community could benefit from that, but it feels like it's been so hard to get kickstarted. And maybe it's just that we don't now that we've actually got this sweet component framework, you know, maybe now that kind of can be more of a possibility.
I think that's the case. I mean, the tools did not exist for this level of composition. And if you disagree, I ask you to then explain, why are there so many date pickers in the world that all have overlapping behavior and typically vary in the following two ways? They're designed to work within a particular code framework, which is a bummer, right? Like, there's the jQuery date picker, there's the MooTools date picker, or they vary in the sense of, like, there's one date picker and it did everything I need except, oh, I need to be able to localize into Swedish and this one doesn't do localizations. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't expose to you the points where you would be like, okay, but, like, before you display text, please give it to this object I'm going to provide to you and it will tell you what to display. And its default is, like, you know, just display the text you sent in, but you can augment it with behavior of, like, translate it, reverse it, turn it into an animated GIF, whatever. Like, I can't find any library of components that's doing that. And I think it's just, we just didn't have the language to describe that yet. And I think we're getting very, very close to it.
Right. And I think it still requires it's still going to require a lot of effort for someone to do it that kind of right, composable and shareable way. But hopefully, at least with this wave, we can get it, you know, someone can put in that effort once and we can all benefit from it. Because I think, like, what's going on right now is it's just like the path of least resistance is, like, I've got that choice of like five or six date pickers and I'll pick the one that's the least square for my current hole. I'll kind of have to, like, you know, file some stuff off the edges and do some bespoke work. And so, yeah, maybe I'll only have to spend a couple days, but then it's going to, you know, it's going to bite me for the next six months or, you know, for the rest of the project.
It's interesting. In Ember and in fact, many of the JavaScript frameworks are all in the land grab for, I call this TJ Holloway checking. Where you,
I know exactly where you're going.
What you do is you basically go to a new territory that does not have the libraries available to it that other territories do, and you port over the existing libraries into this new world. So I think TJ, and this is not to knock doing that, like, this is valuable, right? Like, TJ basically looked at Sinatra and copied it and made Express. Right. And another, a number of other libraries, and people do this all the time. There's like a land grab every time a new like React comes out. Well, it's lacking an autocomplete. It's lacking a router. It's lacking, you know, all the things that a new framework doesn't have. People will look at the tools they're using in their existing ecosystem and port them over. And sometimes, I mean, some people build entire, like the beginning of their careers is like, I wrote the whatever like that you used to have in Java, but couldn't use in Ruby. And now you can use it in Ruby because I ported it over. Mm-hmm. And they get a lot of credit for that. And sometimes I think that's unfortunate because the hard work is not writing the code. The hard work is figuring out what code to write. And the original author of those libraries, like they probably struggled for years to get the right API, to cull away the things that were not necessary. And for me, it's just hilarious to see people look at the output of that and be like, okay, well, I know the problem space because someone described it for me. I'm just now going to translate it to a new environment. And everyone, like, if they're not familiar with the environment where it's being ported from, is like, you're so prolific. How do you code so much? and I'm guilty of this as well, actually. Pretender is in many ways looking at existing HTTP mocking libraries and seeing how they were organized and what they were doing and cutting away the parts that I didn't want and turning it into more a collection of smaller libraries acting in tandem and less of like a large framework. Lest anyone think I am pointing fingers at people who are, you know, becoming famous on the work of others, I too am guilty of benefiting from the work of others who have investigated a very complicated problem space, seeing the solution and then cribbing from it. The land grab right now is like, you know, every new framework, people are like, well, it needs an autocompleter, it needs a date picker. I don't think anyone yet has thought like to not do that pattern either with Ember or with React. We don't want a date picker. We want all the things with which a person could build a date picker that is right for the task they're trying to solve. And I think that's like the next big wave in sort of user interface component libraries is to make it a user interface component framework, which is not as sexy, right? Like I don't think you'll get as many immediate adherents if you're like, if you don't have a slider and a date picker and a layout system and modals, if all you have is the tools to build those, that's not as compelling. But I think it's the appropriate level of reuse that would allow a project to sort of continue for years to come.
So it's basically sort of a call for component authors or for completed widget authors to start thinking in terms of reusable primitives.
Yes.
Underneath.
Yep. And the weird thing about a primitive is what makes it not sexy is it's not actually useful on its own. It is necessary, mm-hmm. but not sufficient to solve a user facing programming problem. And that's not fun, right? Like people want to ship the whole thing, consume it from scratch, and the user can just use it, which is awesome. Like that, we should still have that. That is incredibly valuable to be able to say, I need a date picker. This is a known pattern that users are familiar with. What is the date picker I should use? The trouble, and this was like the point of my Ember camp talk a couple of years ago, was you inevitably need to customize that behavior. That will just happen to you. It's not an if, it's a when. And most components are not set up to handle that case. And so what they'll do is, as a component evolves over time, it will get more and more options you can pass into its constructor, for example, as like flags that will flag different behavior on and off.
Right. I call that the configuration ball pattern.
And it's
you kind of have to stuff in a configuration ball
exactly. And a small number of them is fine. Probably the biggest abuser of this pattern I've ever seen is TinyMCE. Which has, I think, something like upwards of 400 or 500 different configurations options, many of which are like logically incompatible with each other, right? Like you set these two things to true, like that is not meaningful in a semantic sense. But the program doesn't prevent you from doing that. You just have to know not to do that. And that level of customization through option setting is a clear indication that like there are primitives below that should have been the things being shared.
I think it's an easy trap to fall into, because I see that, like, I used to be this way as well, but I feel like people don't want to be writing the same markup over and over again.
Yes.
Which is fair, but if you're making a component just to avoid sharing markup, it's always just kind of bitten me because like now that needs to have like, if I'm on this page, it needs to like have maybe some other stuff, and then mm-hmm. it's harder for me to maintain in the long run than if I had just copied the markup.
Yeah.
And I think components are kind of moving that way too.
For me, the success point in components, and this doesn't have to be specific to Ember, obviously, like any framework, will be when I don't need to change any existing templates and I don't need to change any existing JavaScript to integrate with a new Bootstrap-like layout library, right?
Right.
Like something comes, you know, it's like the successor to Bootstrap and Foundation is coolmarkup.css, and I can pull in the date picker. And it has the place where I can override and be like, okay, add these CSS classes, use this wrapping template. In the date picker, I can drill down to particular elements to be like, when you are showing a date, it needs to be this element of these CSS classes and show this text. That level of overriding where I can be like, no, use this one instead, please, instead of options passing, I think will be the mark of success. Because right now, if you wanted to do use Bootstrap style with a different date picker, you can't. You end up, you know, cracking open the code and starting to change things.
Yeah, you fork everything that you were supposed to not have written yourself.
Yes, which is interesting. The research on that, the amount of customization where it would have just been cheaper to write from scratch is shockingly low, 20 to 25%. Wow. Which is right, like a quarter. So if you think about any time you have started to customize a library, if you need to change more than 20% of the behavior, the research has indicated that it would have been cheaper to just write one that was single purpose, exactly what you needed, which is very, very low. I think most people's gut instinct would be 50% or something like that, but it is in fact much lower.
It's just because you pay it over a longer period, but yes. you know you pay that interest more. It's just like people are shocked to find out how much they actually pay for their houses.
Yeah, exactly.
That's I don't know. The tools are there now. It's like the tooling is there. I feel like you're pushing on this door and it's finally sort of starting to creak open a little bit. Yeah. And you've been like leaning with all your weight against it for a few years. So hopefully as that starts to creak open, you'll start to see these libraries start sneaking in and become, you know, ideally cross-compatible between different ways people want to write their JavaScript, because the primitives are so well known or well established.
I think there is going to be like an activation energy, and like the leap will be quantized, just because all of a sudden, you know, in a very short time period, the path of least resistance will become to use these kind of more expressive primitives rather than kind of reach for the old things. And once that becomes the path of least resistance, then, you know, all the traffic will go there immediately.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
At least I certainly hope so.
We've delayed the development of Ember documentation probably long enough. there's tons more stuff I wanted to talk to you about like Pretender and about your work in Ember and recent cool stuff. We have to do this again.
For sure.
We have to do this again.
Gladly
this was
come on again.
Awesome. I learned a lot, and I just want to say on behalf of the entire community, like, we use the stuff that you do every day, and it means a lot, and it matters a lot to us, and I know that it can be sort of frustrating and thankless, and so, like, let's throw one thank in the infinite thankless bucket somewhere. Thank you very much for the work that you do.
You're more than welcome. I do it, honestly, for me. I write these tools because I need them, and I don't want to have to write them, so I want other people to work on them for me.
well, hopefully there, you know, it, and so let's ask, is there something, it'll be about a week between when we record this and when people hear it. Once this is heard by people, is there some way or some place that people listening that are interested in Ember and wondering how they might contribute, but not sure how to start? Is there something you want to kind of throw out there for people to jump in and help with?
Probably there is a oft-repeated statement that writing documentation is a great way to get started in open source. And it actually, it pains me a little bit because I think good documentation requires you to be to both understand the source as well as the author did, and then also as a side skill be excellent at technical writing, which is actually a pretty high bar for people. The way I wish people who would like to come to open source, and this is true for not just Ember, any project, is to use the products, and everywhere you encountered something that was surprising or an error message that didn't make sense, try to distill down what you were doing and figure out, like, either on your own or through working with the contributors to the project, like, where you went wrong, because in many cases that can be detected. And you can be the last person to ever make that mistake, because a future version will be like, oh, you passed true here. We never thought anyone would do that, but I see what you're trying to do, and that's not actually possible. Please do this instead. I would say, like, the way I would like people to participate in Ember is to use it and make mistakes, and help us figure out how we could have prevented you from making those mistakes in the first place through, usually through better error messaging. Documentation is incredibly helpful, but I think everyone's been in a situation where they're using software and they just hit a giant, what? We're like, you read the docs, I'm doing exactly that. Like, I understand this. Yep. Why, what is happening? And you have gotten into a situation that is almost certainly detectable. If we can just figure out how you got there, we can figure out what path you took that was bad, and we can make sure no one ever goes down that path again. So I would say use all open source software, make mistakes, and then work to make sure that you're the last one to ever have to make that mistake.
So essentially file a bug report on a frustration.
Yeah, yeah. And the most important thing about bug reports is not like, hey, I called a thing and I got, I can't call length on undefined, right? Or undefined is not a function. That these are not useful. Yeah. These are not useful, right? Like that's...
Right.
That is not the actual error, right? That is a sad fact that the application or the framework behaved in a way that we never thought you would end up in this particular world. We really either need your help in backtracking to like where you went wrong, or isolating to a case where you can reproduce what went wrong, and explaining like why you thought that was an okay thing, because. I think all software developers aspire to Matz's principle, least surprise design ethic of when approaching an unfamiliar task in a familiar language or framework, like it should be obvious what you do next. It should just be like, oh yeah, well obviously I call this method. Like the number of times I have been surprised, pleasantly surprised in Ruby, where like, oh, I'm sure I can just use the shovel method on this collection. I don't even know what this collection is, and it works, and it behaves all the ways that it should. Like that's a wonderful, like the emergent properties of a well-designed system where you feel much more skilled in it than you actually are, is amazing for a developer. And like when I get to do that, it makes me feel much smarter than I really am. But it only gets that way if we being the developers of a library, understand the mental state that someone had when they were attempting a thing, right? Like your instincts about what you were trying to do are not wrong. Like I don't like when people, there's a really unpleasant blog that, you know, shows people being jerks to each other in open source. And one of the common patterns is, I tried to do something in jQuery, and instead of the answer being like, oh, sorry, jQuery doesn't do that. It operates with collections. And so that, you know, you don't have just one item, you have a bunch of items. People will say things like, oh, you know, given that you're answering this question or even attempted that, it's clear you don't understand how jQuery works. Like that's not useful. Like the developer or the user's instinct about how a thing should be used is correct to them, right? Like their mental model of it has led them to a path where what they're doing is correct. They're not trying to use something in a way that is bizarre. And the best way that I know to guide them back to a happy path is to catch as many of those as possible, go, ah, I see what you did there, but that actually can't happen, and here's why.
And that's a compliment, I think, that can be paid to Ember for sure, is that the error messages really work to reflect the mental state of the developer, like, and are very explicit. And so reporting basically helps grow the model,
yes,
the mental model of the people that might be using it at a given time. So That's very nuanced. I was expecting you to say open a pull request.
No, don't do that. It's no, I mean actually, like there is. You're trying to get me to stop talking, but it'll never happen. There is a well-known problem called the curse of knowledge, where like I should not write guides anymore. I don't understand what it's like to be someone learning Ember. Mm-hmm. I can help shape the mental model of people who are trying so that they can better explain to the folks who are going to be trying in the near future what that experience is like. But I just can't do it anymore. That's just not, I'm not in the world. So the, like, I don't think open source projects show enough respect or like acceptance of beginners. Like that beginner mindset is incredibly valuable to your project. I think it's actually more valuable to your project than having people who are experts writing new features. The beginner mindset, like you must do what you can to capture that, because that's actually what improves your software, is making it least less and less surprising as more and more people approach it from more varieties of backgrounds and experiences.
So that's the, okay, so I'm going to use one analogy. So basically, you start with this incredible store of empathy for what people must be going through because you're going through it or have just recently gone through it, mm-hmm. that erodes as you gain more experience, and explaining what happened to you and how it was surprising is a way to grow and restock that empathy.
Yes.
For like as you build the framework.
Yep.
So it's really important that people participate in that way. I had not thought of that. That's very insightful. Thank you.
It's you'll find curse of knowledge if you go read up on the concept, and you'll find it in yourself everywhere. Anyone asks you like, huh, why did you do that? Or how did you know to do that? Often you can't answer the question. You don't know anymore, right? Like you have turned it into an internal heuristic and you actually cannot explain it. What you did was accurate and correct and the best answer, and you have no idea why. And that is how humans behave. And then
it makes you angry.
Yes. Like, why don't I know how I do this? I don't know. Like I've been data modeling for 15 years and people be like, oh, like why'd you make that a Hasmini style association to these objects? Like, not to give you a tautology, but because it is a Hasmini relationship to these things. I just can't, you know, I can't just explain how some of my decisions are made, which is very, very frustrating. Mm-hmm. But then you go do new things and you're like, oh my God, I'm horrible at everything. So if I could do one pick, it would be, go do something totally bizarre and new. If you ever feel like you're real hot shit, go start something you've never done before. And, you will recognize how much better everyone is at everything compared to you. in aggregate, the everyone are better at everything than you.
Well, I never go to a meetup or a conference where I don't feel superior. So I hope everybody listening gets that as a reference to a not nice tweet. So anyway, well, Trek, thank you very much for sharing your time with us and your thoughts. And I wish that you would actually host a podcast and I would listen to it every dang week if you were to do such a thing.
You don't want that. I would just talk for literally 8 hours a day. but thank you for thinking that. You should speak to anyone who's ever been a coworker of mine and say, how much more would you like to hear Trek's thoughts on things? I think the answer would be, 50% less.
All right. Well, let's leave them one and more. Thanks again, Trek.
Thank you.
Have a wonderful afternoon, and we'll talk to you later.
Let's do it again. Bye-bye.
Okay.
Bye. Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks, everybody. That was episode 28. Appreciate you tuning in. And if there's anything you want to hear, anything you want to tell us, just drop us a line. We're on Twitter at The Frontside, or you can also reach us at frontside.io.